I will be presenting some recent developments in computer algebra for theoretical physics. So to start with, why computers? We physicists do our computations with paper and pencil, and we are very successful in doing so. So why would we use computers in the first place? I think there are several advantages for that. I want to emphasize that most of my friends do not use computers, and but I think I have a point. So to start with, we can concentrate more on the ideas instead of on the algebraic computations. There is a kind of obvious meaning for this sentence, but there is a subtle one. And the subtle one is that in theoretical physics, we used to do computations using a very abstract and dense notation so that we really need to focus on not making mistakes and making the right manipulations at the time of computing. While if you program these methods, the mathematical methods and the notation in the computer, for the computer, this is straightforward, it's just a flash. And we can use all our brain power concentrating on the ideas and the formulation. And I think this is a very big thing. The second thing that I would mention is that we can extend results in very easy ways. For instance, we can change the values of some parameters. We can add equations to our system. We can change the form of the potential or et cetera. And by rerunning the formulation we have done in a computer algebra worksheet, we just get the new results after changing the formulation almost instantly, as opposed to redoing all the computations by hand. The interesting example I have for that is that my PhD thesis was more or less 80 pages on quantization of supersymmetry. And I need, in fact, to correct a mistake and redo all the computations again. Well, you go by hand, it's possible, you do it. We become strong in doing that. But there is no meaning. Another good reason is that we can explore the mathematics surrounding a given problem. For instance, we can get a particular case and run a numerical experiment to check some hypotheses. We can compute series, do plotting, I don't know, a number of things. Maybe there are some special functions popping up as results of differential equations. We can know about these special functions, convert one to the other one, etc. And not less important, if not the most important, we can share results in very easy ways, very productive ways, actually, because once we put the formulation of a problem into a computer algebra worksheet, we can send this to a colleague with whom we are working. This colleague can rerun the computation, get exactly the same result, analyze the formulation, change something in the formulation, just press the button, everything gets run in a second, and send the worksheet back. And doing this process, we can interact in very productive ways. So if it's so good, why is that it wasn't used more? I think that's the main question. And my understanding is that there is a severe representation problem in the design of these computer algebra systems. There was a severe representation problem. And I identify mainly three things that I will go through. So for instance, if you go to the Wikipedia and open the page for Maxwell equations, you will see this table of formulas where you see coordinate-free representations for vectors, for instance, B and E, coordinate-free representations for differential operators, nabla, different kinds of products, cross product, dot product, differential operators like the D'Alemberti represented by a square, or the space-time differential operator with covariant, contravariant indices, sum rule for repeated indices, Einstein notation, or here now in general relativity, you see the covariant derivative operator. Behind this symbol, there are the Christoffel symbols defined in terms of some combination of derivatives of the space-time metric, and so on. And computer algebra systems were not designed to work with such a dense notation, little small symbols representing so many mathematical concepts. So this is one thing. The second thing that where this the design of these systems failed, I think, for many years, is that in physics, we typically want to, for instance, take this first thing, divergence of B. Sometimes we want to actually perform the operation, so compute the divergence of B for some given B in components. But sometimes no, we know the form of B, but we want to proceed the computation just representing the divergence with just this upside down triangle, the dot, and the letter B. So there is the concept of performing the computation or representing it without performing it, which means we know all the mathematical properties of the object. We can differentiate, simplify, compute series, etc. But we don't want to compute it. And in physics, we keep doing this back and forth. So this is an interesting concept, but these systems were not designed for that. Were designed for you give the command and the operation is computed. And the situation is not different with respect to quantum mechanics, where the standard notation is Dirac's notation. So for instance, this is a ket that, say, in a continuous basis is represented by this integral. This is a bra. This is the product of a bra and a ket, represented by this integral from minus infinity to plus infinity of the conjugate of the function phi, etc. This, for instance, is the mean value of a quantum operator. It's an object that doesn't commute under multiplication. And here we have the third representational issue. Computer algebra systems were designed to compute on a commutative domain. And I'm not talking about matrices and just collections of objects in arrays. I'm talking about doing algebraic computation with non-commutative objects for real. Put the product and take those properties into account. This wasn't possible in computer algebra systems. So, and we want to compute with notation like the one you see on the left-hand side, but with the meaning, the mathematical meaning you see on the right-hand side. And of course, this wasn't possible by default in computer algebra systems. So all this has changed, mostly up to what I can think. We are pretty close to closing the project. And what I will do is illustrate what we have with some examples. So in order to illustrate this, I choose some examples from classical mechanics, quantum mechanics, and relativity. In the presentation, I am not interested in the physics behind these problems. We all know the physics is relatively simple. What I am interested in is in the algebraic manipulations we do to tackle these problems formally when we work in theoretical physics. So starting with something as simple as possible, I'll choose a problem from classical mechanics. The problem is to determine the inertia tensor of a three-atomic molecule. This problem is a classic problem from Landau book for mechanics. So given a three-atomic molecule, there is an isosceles triangle, two masses equal masses on the basis. The distance between them is A, the height of the triangle is H, and we have the third atom over the third axis. So we want to compute the inertia tensor of this problem. So in what I will show, I am showing the whole input I type in the computer to process the problem. There is no fancy thing, no trick. And the computation is actually performed in real time, which means nothing is pre-computed in this moment. It will run on the fly while I'm doing the presentation. So first, I load the package, and I introduce the main information for the formulation of the problem, which is the formula of the inertia tensor. And we already see some of the new objects. So this R is a coordinate-free representation for the positions of the particles as viewed from the center of mass. This represents the I and the J components of these same vectors that point to each of the three atoms as viewed from the center of mass. M is the mass. You see in gray the sum, which means whenever it appears in gray, it means it's representing the operation but not performing it. This is very important. I don't want to have this sum expanded. I want to represent the formula in compact way as a sum. Essentially, all what we need to do is to compute. Now enters the human with the physics of the problem. How do we compute the positions of the three atoms as viewed from the center of mass, insert these values into the inertia tensor, and get the components of the matrix? So in our problem, there are three particles. And let's write now taking advantage of the computer, the matrix for the inertia tensor. For that purpose, we construct a mapping that maps the indices into the component of the inertia tensor, and in this way, we write the whole matrix in one shot. So we see on the diagonal the standard formulas for the inertia tensor, for the inertia tensor, and out of the diagonal, we also see the standard formulas related to the combinations of different directions for the inertia tensor. So now it's time to compute this little r that represents the position of the vectors as viewed from the center of mass. Well, we do it in the standard way. We will switch to a different reference, which is an arbitrary reference, could be anyone, where the positions of these vectors are represented by this capital R, and the position of these atoms as viewed from the center of mass are equal to the position viewed from an arbitrary system minus the position of the center of mass. So now I am going to compute this. These guys depend on my choice of the system of reference, which could be anyone. So for convenience, that will be clear at the end. I will choose the origin of this arbitrary system of reference over the line that joins the two atoms on the base of the triangle, and the orient the vertical axis passing through the third atom. So the first atom is positioned to the left at a distance a divided on 2 of the origin. We see, again, an object that is new is unit vectors. So I am actually computed with abstract algebraic vectors, not arrays of matrices or lists. The second atom is positioned in the vertical at a distance h. And the third atom is positioned to the right at a distance a divided on 2. So I now have these three, which depends on just the convention, my choice of a system of reference. My problem continues with the fact that the mass of the atom 3 is equal to the mass of the atom 1. So we set that. And then we go with the computation of the center of mass. The center of mass is just an average of the positions of each of these particles. We use a standard formula, again in gray, an operation that is inert or represents the computation but is not performed. If I want, I can perform it. So that's the position of the center of mass. So now I have the three vectors here, and I have the position of.
Yes. So R of J is equal to 1.1.1.10.
Yes.
So J here seems to be related to the particle number.
Whereas yes.
The J refers to the coordinate.
No, to the particle number.
Ah, I see. This is defined. Okay.
Yes. So as soon as we have the three positions of the three particles in an arbitrary system of reference, and we have the position of the center of mass using this formula introduced at the beginning, formula ends with 1.5, we have the three positions viewed from the center of mass. So these are. So it's not just a matter of inserting these values into this matrix and ask the system to perform all those summations, simplify whatever it can, and show me the result. So this were, and there we are. So nice. It comes very fast. All those zooms, blah, 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 suddenly compact into a simple expression. Now. A comment, you see that the inertia tensor came diagonal. This is because of the choice of the system of reference. So making one of the points that I was commenting one or two pages ago, what happens if, for instance, I change the value of the mass of the third atom and say, well, it's actually 2 times the mass of the first atom. It's not equal. Well, no problem. Just press the buttons again and get the inertia tensor for the new problem as opposed to go all the computations by hand. This is a typical thing of computer algebra. So it takes some time for you to formulate the problem, but as soon as it's formulated, the advantages are enormous. And you put all your focus on the formulation of the problem, not on the algebraic computation. So summarizing this problem, what we have is coordinate free representations for vectors, Kronecker delta, operations that are represented by not performed, and well, there we are. So let's move into something more interesting. Not that it's not interesting, but something less straightforward. So now I want to compute the quantum components of, so the components of the quantum of angular momentum operator, and verify using tensor notation that their commutator satisfies this relation, where this is actually the imaginary unit that I would represent with a lowercase letter, and this is the Levi-Civitas symbol. I advance that the display in different color has to do with the fact that these objects are non-commutative, so we implemented that non-commutative objects are displayed in one color, commutative in a different color, and anti-commutative in yet a different color, and then you have a rapid visual grasp of what is what you are computing with. Okay, so let's see how we can formulate. So we load the package, we indicate that space indices will be represented with lowercase letting, so this is a convention. We define L, R, and P as tensors, which means when we compute with them, please take into account Einstein's sum rule of repeated indices and use the information you have about their components. And now it's time to set up the main physics behind the problem. And the main physics is that these three are quantum operators and that they are governed by the commutation rules between position and momentum, represented in tensor notation. We know R with R is 0, P with P is 0, and R with P is a Kronecker delta. Let's verify how this works. So for instance, this, when we put an ampersand prefixing means, this is the operation, but please do not perform it. Just display it and represent it. So this is it, R and P, and we can transform this into an active operation by asking its value. It comes right, okay. So now we will perform the left-hand side in inert form, the right-hand side in active form. So indeed, R with R is 0, and P with P is 0. So now we want to verify that if L is written in that form, and it is, because this is just the vector product between R and P written in tensor notation, then we want to verify that the following rule is true. Of course, the logic is simple. If I introduce this formula here and take into account the three commutation rules that I have, then everything should come together. I simplify taking into account repeated indices. There will be some, here is L times L, there will be some products of Levi-Civitas symbols. When you multiply, they become sums of products of deltas, of Kronecker deltas. All this should happen. So I need to introduce this expression here. So the first one comes straightforward here, but for the second one, I need to change J by K, but I need to be careful because there is already K here, and the index cannot be repeated more than once. And moreover, that will be product of things, and the index cannot be repeated more than once as well. So I need to avoid all these collisions by hand. You go carefully trying to not commit a mistake. Well, for the computer, this is straightforward. And if I want to solve the problem in one go, okay, just simplify the commutator, taking into account the commutator rules and the sum rule for repeated indices. And indeed, both expressions are the same. So these times this was transformed into sums of products of deltas. Then the deltas were applied to this core thing. Then the commutation rules were taken into account, and this is it. If we go into steps, just to make it not so automatic, well, we can first expand the commutator, so it will be one term times the other minus the other times the first equals to the right-hand side, and then simplify again. And of course, we get the same thing. So summarizing, what we are doing here is using non-commutative objects, using abstract tensor notation, simplifying with respect to repeated indices, and using predefined algebra rules, which are the commutator rules behind this problem. Okay, let's go with a more interesting problem. So now I want to verify that the energy of a particle moving in a magnetic field that is constant and is oriented along some axis is quantized, which means the eigenvalues of this operator can assume just certain values. Here, this constant is well known. This is called the cyclotron frequency. Doesn't matter. These are annihilation and creation operators. And for everyone who works in particle physics, this is kind of standard notation. So, okay, how do we do that? We load the package. We indicate that there are some Hermitian operators, so they satisfy certain properties. They are all these. Then they are also understood to be quantum operators, which for the system means something. And there are some real objects. We tell that all these here are real objects. We will use some compact display because we don't want to see redundant information all the time. And this is typical when we do computations by hand. We understand that A depends on the coordinates x and y. And now it's time to introduce the formulation of the problem. We get open any textbook, and we find that the Hamiltonian can be written in this form. So this is the momentum of the particle. This is the electromagnetic field, the charge, the speed of light, the mass of the particle. So what we need to do now is essentially to transform this expression into an expression in terms of annihilation and creation operators. So for that purpose, we first introduce this thing as an operator, just to work with it. We substitute, and so that the Hamiltonian can be written in this manner. And now we want to derive commutation rules for the components of pi. This is a typical textbook example. So we start with the basis of this problem, which are the commutation rules between position and momentum. And what we need to do is to express these components in terms of the x and the p's, so in terms of r and p. And because these commutation rules are known, then we will know the commutations between these two. Then we express that commutator in terms of annihilation and creation operators, and we substitute in the Hamiltonian, and we will solve the problem. So let's do that. We first compute the components. We introduce the components of these three vectors, and we construct an equation substituting in this equation 2, 2, 4. So we now have a vectorial equation, which means we can take the component in the direction 1, the component in the direction 2. So now we have px and py and expressed in terms of p's and of the components of A. If we were able to tell what's the dependence of A on position, we have the p's in terms of p and r, and therefore we could right away compute the commutation rules for these guys. So in practice, what I am saying is that we want to take the commutation, the commutator between these two equations, it automatically distributes. So the commutator of the left-hand side is equal to the commutator of the right-hand side. And we see that we have three of them that couldn't be computed further because we don't know how these guys depend on position. Yes?
I don't know about anybody else, but I don't really need a revision course on quantum mechanics. I would like to know how the syntax works for your package, because it is significantly different from the last version that you
I don't understand exactly your question.
The last version of Maple that I used was Maple 10. That was when you rolled out the new interface, which I found impossible to work with, so I reverted to the old one. The new Maple install that I have on my machine does not support the old interface. Right? Now I look at this, which is presumably using the new interface, which is modeled on a spreadsheet. You really haven't defined what those notation symbols mean. Instead, you've concentrated on reiterating quantum mechanics that we all didn't understand.
Okay.
So I think the purpose of this lecture here is to give a high-level overview of the features enabled by the new interface. And there will be
yes.
And in the afternoon at 1 o'clock, there will be a hands-on session where things will be explained in more detail for those people interested in working with Maple. So That's in the Alice room from 1 o'clock to 3 o'clock. And we have some evaluation licenses in case you're interested in bringing a laptop and getting into the details. But before people are actually interested in learning the details, it's important to tell people what actually is enabled by all the details.
Yeah, but I...
the high-level features, which is what this lecture is about.
I want to...
Well, that's not necessary for Rebecca. I don't quite know the concept, and I would like to understand what it's capable of.
But I would still like to know how the syntax works. Because showing me that it can jump through a loop, well, that's cute. But actually knows it.
Eric just told you that there will be a session in the afternoon that might be more suitable for what you want.
All right. Well,
yeah, I want answer something to what you are saying. Please don't get mad. The current version of Maple is Maple 18. More or less is one per year, so think 8 years ago it would be Maple 10. The package has changed significantly since its first release. In fact, it changes every week, and the changes are available to everyone on the web every week. So people used to give some feedback, kind of, this doesn't work. We go fix it, put the fix available, or new developments according to our own plan. So I really can't answer why this would or would not work in Maple 10 8 years ago. It's not possible. Now you touch on another problem, which is the graphical user interface. It's true, I am using the graphical user interface, the new one, that you said that it doesn't work for you or in your computer, or many reasons I have heard. I have my own concerns about the interface as well. But I want to explain that I am not illustrating the graphical user interface. What I am illustrating is new kind of algebraic manipulations that can be done in computer algebra that couldn't be done before the development of this package, and that, in fact, as far as I know, cannot be done in any other computer algebra system. So the fact that we have these objects, these representations, and we can perform these computations is new, and that's what I am showing. And the graphical user interface is an underlying issue, is the background I need in order to make the things visible. How do you do?
Well, I'm delighted that you have some new techniques that you can use in your package. I would like to know what the syntax is so that I can use them.
The syntax. Well, the syntax is what I am showing here. I must be missing something. How to load it? Well, I'm trying to understand your question, being honest. I open Maple. All I'm doing is I open Maple and I type restart to avoid what was before. I load the package by writing this, and then start setting things and computing. It's not that I'm doing something else. Something else is going here on background that I'm not showing. This is the syntax. So there is nothing that is not being shown.
All right, I'll give you an example. Maple always used to handle lists and vectors separately. Right? And if you don't understand the difference between the two, you can get into trouble real fast. You have a program which, as far as you can tell, is algebraically correct, but which produces gibberish. Now, that's to do with variable handling. And you've got some new operator types here. For example, the line beginning with restart looks more or less what I'm familiar with, and I can guess what's in it. Exactly the syntax for setup, on the other hand. I don't think I've seen that before.
Because it's new. So we are not computing. We are not computing with lists anymore. That would be a non-algebraic representation of a vector. We are computing with algebraic representations, either non-projected into any system. The convention is that the standard arrow you see here, you write it, the syntax you're asking is just the letter followed by an underscore. This will produce this object that is understood by the system to have vectorial properties. And when we project into a basis, we still compute with algebraic vectors, not lists or matrices as in the past. In order to do that, we use unit vectors. And the unit vectors have following the same convention, just that the underscore is on the other side.
Right, but it seems like that, like how do you do the variable handling in the new version so you can support these in your algebraic objects? That's the sort of thing that you might
But there are several levels to approaching that, the high level and the low level approach. And the high level approach is the kind of information that, say, a faculty member would need to know to find out whether the students should learn the package. And this is what this talk is about.
Yeah,
I'll be happy if I see you in the tutorial. But I think right now we should concentrate in the talk, not on the syntax of how this is done, but rather on the semantics and then the features.
Perhaps trying to close my answer to your question. In order to show what we can do, I'm not going, for instance, into explaining this detail, just showing how complicated or simple would be to enter the computation. In this hands-on, we would discuss, okay, how do you compute with this? How do you enter this? How do you do that? But at this point, I am happy with showing this is the syntax, it's no more than that. It is close enough to what I do by hand. This is the output, this is the display of the output, and this is the mathematical functionality behind the syntax. And yes, all the syntax is new, absolutely new, even much newer than Maple 10. Some of these things wouldn't work 1 year ago. So you are correct in that. No, you can compare with Maple 10. OK, I will resume. So all what we need to do now in order to compute, derive the computation rules for this object is to compute the dependence of the electromagnetic field A, of the potential, sorry, in terms of the position. For the form of the electric field, this is very easy to guess. In Cartesian coordinates, this vector function already gives me what I want. So take the divergence of both sides of the equation, and indeed, this is the Coulomb gauge. Take the curl, and indeed, the curl of this vector potential gives me this very easy form of the magnetic field. So I have this expression for the components of the potential A in terms of the coordinate and some constants. These are the unit vectors. Again, I am only doing this. There is nothing else on background that I am doing. So I convert that into a set of equations and now substitute in the expression for the commutator of the components of pi that enters the Hamiltonian. And I have everything ready. So the substitution just throw the values here. Now you see R and P, R and R, P and R. So the substitution just throw the values and invoking the expression, all these computators get commuted. So now we have the commutation rule for the components of pi. We add this piece of information to the system, meaning, okay, from now on, whatever you compute, take that into account at the time of considering products. And now we introduce an annihilation operator as a linear combination of the pi. There are some normalization constants. We take the dagger of that to construct the creation operator. This means take the dagger in Maple, so this is the syntax. So now take the commutator between the two equations. So the commutator on the left-hand side is equal to the commutator on the right-hand side. Now we see why these factors, so that this is equal to 1, because the system knows about these guys, the commutation rule they satisfy, we just derived and added that to the knowledge, then the commutator can compute that, so we are in track. So, okay, now take the product of these two equations, we get there, and now simplify, taking into account the commutator rules that the system already knows, and we have this expression that is quadratic in the components of px and py. Yes?
What would happen if you didn't add this new for the commutator and the compute, say, 2.25? Like, would it understand that?
If we express these guys in terms of x and y, yes, because it knows the commutation rules for x and y.
It's just more work, right?
Yes. Exactly, put some substitution. No, you can say, okay, I just derived a new commutation rule that is a consequence of the starting commutation rules plus the physics of my problem. So, okay, from now on, take that into account and don't ask me to write everything in terms of position and momentum. So, okay, this can be simplified further. This is the frequency, so we can express the constant magnetic field in terms of the frequency and substitute in the expression for the product of A dagger A. And compare now with the Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian is here, is proportional to pi squared, to the norm of the vector. This operator has these components, and this product has this form, so it's clear that one thing can become the other. Substitute, expand, and what we want now to do is to simplify this expression, taking into account that equation, and in doing so, do the following. Try to remove occurrences of squares of pi. This is what this input line performs. So do that, we get that thing, and just collect terms, and we find what we wanted. That is that the Hamiltonian can be written in this form, and therefore we know that the eigenvalues for this problem has this form, and therefore are quantized. So the kind of algebraic manipulation, which is new, that we can do now, is illustrating this problem, we are computing with quantum vector operators and algebra rules that are derived, added, and transformed into a result. Oh, yes.
Earlier you performed, well, when you performed the divergence method, so is there something in that syntax that makes it do the calculation explicitly rather than leaving it symbolic? Because you end up with something in terms of unit vectors rather than just A, divergence of A equals divergence of A. So if you wanted to just leave divergence of A explicit, how would you do that?
Okay, first of all, are you referring to these equations?
Yes.
Well, the thing is this. I'm using compact display, mentioned at the beginning, but the main idea is when you see A, it's actually A as a function of x, y. Mm-hmm. The left-hand side in the equation 2, 2, 15 is just A as a function of x and y. The right-hand side is the actual components. When you apply the nabla operator, it distributes on the left and on the right. When it gets the left, says, okay, this is just a function. I don't know who this function is, so returns uncomputed, which is what we see here. When it gets its hands on the right, it says, okay, but this I know how to compute. It's the divergence of this vector function, and this I can compute explicitly, I get zero.
Okay, I guess the main question I was asking, because you're doing the operation on the
Yes, yes. Of course, I could use percentage divergence, and then the operation would not be done in any of the two sides. But in this case, for representation purpose, here is the fastest thing. So, okay, I conclude this problem. Now I would like to go with the field equation of a quantum system of identical particles. My problem is to derive the so-called Gross-Pitayevsky equation. This is an equation that's keeping the details. It's useful to represent Bose-Einstein condensates. It's actually the main equation for it. In the hands-on, we can see how to derive perturbed solutions around the stationary solutions of this problem. In this moment, just for the purpose of illustrating the new functionality, I want to derive the field equations. So to do that, well, we do it in two steps. First, we construct the Lagrangian. With it, we construct the action functional, take the functional derivative, equate to zero, and those are the field equations. So yes, by hand is ugly, but for the computer, that's not the problem, and that's one of my points in this talk. So when I'm clicking restart, again, it's only to forget everything from here ahead. I don't want interference of things done in previous problems with regards to this problem. So I load the package again, set the imaginary unit to be this standard symbol, which I prefer, and I will use some compact display to avoid redundant notation. I don't want to see this all the time. So when I see this thing, it means this other thing, and so on. So now we introduce the physics of the problem, which is essentially the key piece of information, which is the expression for the energy of a system of identical particles. This is an arbitrary external potential that is a function of the coordinates and time. This is actually the atom-atom interaction term. This is the interaction constant. This is the norm of the gradient. We see it in gray because it's uncomputed. C is a function that is known to be a function of x, y, z, t. And the gradient could be computed, but I don't want it computed. So represent the operation of the gradient in inner form, and I will work with the norm of this thing. I indicate the real objects of my problem, and now write the Lagrangian in terms of the energy of the problem in the usual way. Up to here, there is no mystery, it's textbooks. So here is where it comes, the algebra of the thing. I want to take that as the core of a four-dimensional integral and compute the functional derivative with respect to the boson field. So would be this operation. I am advancing that here I'm using Plix. It's another technique. I call it Plix. I don't know how you call it in English. Quotes. Acute accent. Okay, quotes. So if I quote the operation, the display is the right, but the operation is not performed. So it's an alternative way. But instead of carrying the inner form again and again, it's just for one time. And I am doing this not because I need, but in order to see what is actually being computed. Otherwise, I invoke the expression, and I directly get the result, which is that. So this is the functional derivative of the action with respect to the field, and therefore is the field equation. It comes very fast. But we see here also, just for fun, there is a Laplacian in disguise. So we can say that take the active equal to the inner form of the Laplacian. And what we want to do is to take the conjugate of this equation and simplify it, taking into account this equation. So that remove, please, this thing and introduce the right thing. We get that, so where we now see the Laplacian. And in order to get the standard form of this equation as seen in textbooks, we isolate the time derivative, collect some terms, and there we are with the Gross-Pitayevsky equation in the standard form you would see in textbooks. Yes?
So you have to conjugate number 5, right?
Yes. No, it's easy to add that functionality, but no, it wouldn't recognize because forget about the physics, where we are simplifying one equation, taking another equation into account. How do you do that? Well, you construct something called a Grobner basis of the problem, define on the fly some rankings to say who is eliminated in favor of who, and perform the operation. But for the computer, a variable or the conjugate of its variable are completely different objects, so the Grobner basis wouldn't work. So you really need to conjugate first in order to simplify one equation with respect to another equation. Now, could this be done automatic? Oh, for sure. In fact, I am using lowercase simplify. This is a syntax detail. It's the standard Maple simplifier, but the physics package comes with its own simplifier, which is with capital S. In Maple, there is this lowercase, upper-lowercase distinction. And what we do is to code all these extra things in the capital simplify. So yes, could be done. But no, it's not there. So what we have seen in this problem, the highlight is the ability to perform functional differentiation, compute with inert vectorial operators, and get, the field equation for this problem. Unitary operators in quantum mechanics is more like a theoretical study that I will jump completely for this presentation because there is no more time, but I leave it for the hands-on experience if someone is interested. So this is a different kind. I will just go some few words. It's a different kind of thing. I am not interested in showing how do you computer results, solve a textbook problem. Well, it's not that. I want to derive knowledge. So start from the basic definition of a unitary operation, unitary operator, and go on by on all the consequences that I could derive from that definition. I'm skipping that and moving into relativity. I choose just two examples. I hope I will be able to finish in time. I know that you were particularly interested in this, although some of your questions were kind of illustrating the previous thing. So my first problem is to derive Maxwell equations departing from the four-dimensional form, tensor form, of the action for electrodynamics. This is a problem of classical field theory. Well, the idea is the same. Write the action for the system and take the functional derivative with respect to the electromagnetic potential field. So, a mu. So we load the package. We define the system of coordinates. And we define a mu to be the 4D electromagnetic potential. Now, up to here, I am calling it the 4D electromagnetic potential. But all I did is define it as a tensor, which for the system means take into account the sum rule for repeated indices and some other little things here and there. OK, I will work with some compact display as well. I don't want to see this whole dependence on the coordinates. So now it's time to enter the definition of the electromagnetic field tensor that we entered in the standard form as this antisymmetric combination of derivatives of the potential A. And again, what we want to do is to take the functional derivative of the action. The action is contracted with a core, which is the contraction of F with itself. It's a four-dimensional integral, and we want to vary A and compute the expansion, take terms up to first order, discard the rest. Well, I don't know what happened. Something wrong? I don't like this. Oh, it's back. Thanks. Don't do that. So we want to perform this computation. So I think this is a simple, however, nice example of what you were asking, Eric. By hand, it's tricky because you are varying a tensor with respect to a tensor function. So you need to take this into account. There are derivatives here that are space-time derivatives. You need to take that into account properly. And by all means, this functionality is not just working over an integral. It works over whatever, over a function, an expression, or whatever. In this case, the expression is an integral. So we delayed one time with these quotes. So we just performed the operation invoking the equation. And there we are with Maxwell equations in tensor form. But for the fact that my friend here is not as happy, there are many simplifications missing, obviously. There is Gemunu, there is Munu, there is the D'Alembertian here, there is a second order differential operator. So clearly, something can be done here. Simplify the expression with respect to the repeated indices, taking into account that this is the metric and the properties of each of these objects. So you load the package. Good question, again, about the syntax. These details I'm skipping just to show a big picture of what can be done. As soon as you load the package, the metric is automatically preloaded as Minkowski with signature minus, minus, minus one, which means time in the last position as opposed to the first, to keep space in positions 1, 2, 3 as the components 1, 2, 3 of the metric. And the zero that you usually see in textbooks is automatically mapped into the fourth component of the matrix. So you can use 0, 1, 2, 3 and works fine. So we simplify with respect to repeated indices, and we get this expression, which is the standard form of Maxwell equations, now simplified in terms of notation. But for the fact that where are the equations, in fact? And we know this is in tensor notation, so the equations are actually the components. So we get the components in this line, get the tensor components, and convert these differential operators to the standard diff notation of the Maple system, and there we are. It's less compact, but there we are with Maxwell equations now in all expanded. So the highlights of this problem is how do we compute functional differentiation with respect to tensor fields. And to conclude, I want to go into a problem in general relativity. When I studied these topics, general relativity was not really in the curriculum for particle physics, which is what I did, more theoretical particle physics. But I hope is something more or less general knowledge nowadays. So this problem is a problem that appeared in a paper of 2013, by a guy called Plamen Fiasev from Europe, and he actually wrote me and said, well, look, I wrote this paper, I did these computations, they were nasty, I want to know if this can be done with this package you are developing. So he sent me the paper, and his paper starts with this form of the metric. Here I'm not entering nothing, there are no input lines, this is just display. And he wants to compute the trace of this expression Z, where phi is some function of the radial coordinates, R is the Ricci tensor, these curly D are the covariant derivatives, there is a second covariant derivative, and T is the stress energy tensor of the problem. Then he wants to compute the trace of that expression, and then here is the definition of the stress energy problem for his stress energy tensor for his problem. He works in spherical coordinates, as is more or less visible. There are two functions in the middle that also enter the metric. And then he wants to compute the components of double, where double is the traceless part of Z. And then he said, OK, not enough. I want to compute an exact solution to the system of differential equations that is behind this. Not happy with numerical things. The paper is withholding potentials, absence of ghosts, and relationship between minimal dilaton gravity and FR theories. Very technical, only for specialists. But the thing is, how do we do algebraically this in the computer? So let's start with, again, the problem. We set coordinates to be spherical. These are theta, phi, phi, and t. And we enter the core of the physics of the problem, which is the square of the line element, is ds. We will use some compact display for the functions involved. The functions involved are v and lambda, so we don't want to display the dependence. So we now set the metric of the problem. And before proceeding, I want to digress 1 minute and just to let you know what happens on background when I do that. And of course, we just entered the metric. I can ask for show me the covariant components of the metric. But the system, as soon as I enter the square of the line element, also knows the contravariant components of the metric, knows about all the components of the Christoffel symbol. For instance, this is the 2 mu mu matrix for the Christoffel symbol, knows about the Ricci tensor of the problem, and knows about all the components of the Riemann tensor of the problem. Without having said anything, we just indicated this is the square of the line element. And this is one of the features of computer algebra. In your brain, you set something, and your brain extends that definition in some direction. So you get for granted some other things that are close to what you define. But for the computer, that thing is much farther away. So you gave a piece of information, and a lot of things automatically are understood for the computer. OK, returning to returning to the problem. We now enter the stress energy tensor as indicated, and I want to define this guy as a tensor, which means the left-hand side will be a tensor under the operations, and the definition of this tensor is given by the components of that matrix. So we define it, meaning from now on, we can compute with this object. We will use compact display for the function phi, and now we introduce the expression we want to compute the trace of, which is Z. Here, R is the Ricci tensor, D are the covariant derivatives of the function phi, T mu nu is the one just described, and we want to compute the trace of this, and the interesting thing is, well, in the computer, we do this in just one go. We define this thing as a tensor, which means from now on, this is an object that the system understands as having tensorial properties, and the components are defined by the components of this expression, where each in turn is the Ricci tensor is defined in terms of derivatives of the Christoffel symbol that are defined in terms of combinations of derivatives of the space-time metric and so on, blah, blah, blah. So if we want the trace, we just write it. And we get the sum of the repeated indices, and there is the trace. Again, we can compute with the trace in abstract form, so don't expand the thing, or just perform the sum over the repeated indices. This is very compact display. The functionality of all the functions is removed, and derivatives are displayed indexed. If you want to show the thing in standard maple notation, it's a bit less compact, but there we are. Now, I want to make a comment about this. This expression and this expression below are not different, are exactly the same for the new. It's just the display that changes. So we have programmed a way to compute with the same objects, but displayed in a way that we can understand much better. So second thing is, how do you compute the traceless part of Z? Well, this is also in one go. The traceless part of Z is defined by Z minus the trace of Z multiplied by the metric divided by the trace of the metric. So again, we define this as a tensorial equation, which means from now on for the system, this is a tensor. All of its components are defined by this. So if we want the traces part of Z, meaning all the components of this, well, now the system knows what that is. So get all of them in one shot, and there we are. And the guy still says, OK, but how about an exact solution to the differential equations that are implicit in this system? So each RR here is second order derivative, for instance. We see some zeros. So get an ODE system with the non-zero components of double first index, covariant, second index, contravariant. And there we have highly nonlinear system of equations. I will skip here the technical details, but essentially when we have a nonlinear system of equations, the solution admits a general case and frequently some singular cases. It frequently happens that the solution to the singular cases are the actually interesting for physics purposes. And in any case, they are much simpler to compute than the solution to the general nonlinear problem. So first, let's run a differential elimination problem with this, trying to split into cases, the general and singular case. I am ending with this symbol, which means don't show. This is a couple of pages of symbols that I'm not interested. But tell me how many cases are there. Are three, meaning one is the general, and there are two singular cases. Show me the length of this. OK, one is big, one is big, one is really small. OK, show me the small one. OK. We are on track. The small one looks like handable. The first equation is actually a constraint. You see no derivatives, a constraint between the functions lambda and phi. There are three functions in a problem. Second equation is a trivial, first derivative of lambda equal to 0. Second equation is a nonlinear equation for v coupled with phi. This is not trivial. The last equation is trivial. It's a first order linear differential equation for phi. So, OK, split into the constraint and the subsystem. And now tackle the subsystem of differential equations. I want an explicit solution for this. It happens to be fully solvable. Very nice. So the solution comes in terms of three arbitrary constants, but we know that we have a constraint in the problem. The constraint is there, is the first equation. So let's insert these solutions for phi, lambda, and v into that constraint and find a relation between these three arbitrary constants. So we do that, and immediately we see there is indeed a relation. So for C1, the expression is linear C1, makes more sense. And insert this form of C1 into the solution of the subsystem of differential equations, and here we are. And I want to stress that we have found a solution to the actual whole problem, not just to the singular case. The definition of a singular case is a case is a singular case if it cannot be derived automatically by restricting parameters in the equation, and if a solution of the singular case also solves the general case. So what we have computed actually is a solution to the whole problem, this ODE system, the nonlinear original. We can see that. Verifying, so ODE test just plugs the solution, performs some simplification, and there we are. All the equations become zero. And the pin. Have more material, but let's stop here. Thank you very much for attending. I hope you enjoy it. I look forward to answering questions, if any.
Thank you very much. I think all of you have the features of the features of the physics package. If questions? Comments on the presentation?
Yes.
Yeah, is it possible to expand these computations to larger dimensions? You are using four dimensions.
Oh, for sure. The dimension is settable. The metric is settable. Everything is settable to whatever you want. And you can also work in many systems of coordinates at the same time, switch from one system to the other. In the case of general relativity, work in tetrad formalism and so on.
So I wanted to mention this before your presentation, but I forgot. So there will be a hands-on session in the Alice room at 1 o'clock. And Edgar provided us some evaluation licenses for Maple. So if you bring your laptop, you can install a modern version of Maple and that particular package. And then there will be a hands-on session teaching you how to get started with it and working on some small example problems there.
One of the biggest problems, honestly, with using these programs is simplifications, because generally, a large problem. Problems you have to simplify in very clever ways in order to be able to work with equations afterwards. So, honestly, in general, it's very hard to get simplifications to come out the way you want them to. Do you have any like strategies for
I understand your question. It's a bit open. First of all, simplification is a word a bit general because you may mean this by simplify or may mean that. That's an issue. So the real thing for me would be whether we have ways to orient the simplifier to arrive where we want, as opposed to one command that will always do what we want, but what we want may change depending on what you need for a given problem. And the answer is, look, we have a real ton of alternatives to do things. Here I just illustrate some. Simplify one thing, taking one equation into account is one of them. Collecting, converting, substituting, or taking properties into account are different things. We have most of that in place. Now, that is a sort of field that is growing. A good example of how it's growing, for instance, the simplification with respect to contracted indices in terms of functions. Well, this is a huge problem that involves Grobner bases, et cetera, et cetera. There are papers almost every year about this. And we keep updating. So if you want perhaps a compact answer, I think we have pretty much what you could do by hand, but I'm sure that you could beat the computer in some specific example. Well, yes, in many ways, because you have many commands, and some of the commands have many options. What I think, because I've been on that side of the equation, the real issue is, for me, okay, looks fancy, but how difficult is to really use it for real purposes? And I think there is a learning curve. There is a strategy for doing that fast, learning rapidly. So how much time takes to learn this thing in order to use it for practical purposes? Probably it's a mini school of 5 days, 2 hours per day, and you are done with the minimum in order to move ahead by yourself.
That's actually not the problem. The problem is that if you don't use it all the time, you forget.
Oh, for sure.
And once you forget the fine detail of these commands, then they stop working properly. So the thing is that most people do need this once every 6 months.
I cannot tell you how do you solve the problem of using this only once every 6 months and keeping in mind lots of details. But
there may be a solution that we offer here at the Perimeter Institute, because that is actually part of my job description. I'm a staff member here, and I'm supposed to be a go-to person for these kind of problems. Now, I'm more familiar with, sorry to say, Mathematica than Maple, and I'm not familiar with this package. But if several people here at Perimeter begin to use this package, then there will be people that you can ask. And they would, if they don't know, dig into the problem and 2 days later come up with a solution.
Yeah.
Maybe even by emailing you or something.
Well, that's one thing. But what I wanted to say is that There is a practical issue here. If you really learn how to find your way through this language, and the idea is to approximate the language as close as possible to what you do with paper and pencil in order to make it possible. So if you are able to jump ahead by yourself, then by consulting the documentation and the very basic knowledge, what happens is that you move into using it not once every 6 months, but almost every week. And as soon as the package, because you can use it for almost everything, honestly. And as soon as the package starts being productive for you, well, you don't want to do things by hand almost anymore, unless it's really beyond what you can do in the computer. Okay. If you allow me to say something from my own experience that is humble and small, however is one, I have the impression that our brains search for problems within range. This within range is written in fade letters. We never think about this. But you have a sort of estimation of how complicated a problem could be from the algebraic point of view. And without thinking, you restrict yourself to something that is manageable, as opposed to thinking about things that are stratospheric from the point of view of the computation. Maybe it would take a year, and who knows, arrives nowhere. Now, as soon as your brain gets the idea that all those algebraic manipulations can be done in a flash, in microseconds, without you almost thinking, then changes the picture in your brain, and you start considering problems that before you would discard automatically. And doing the experiments doesn't take you necessarily to success, but allows you to discard rapidly those ideas that were not useful and engage in those that were useful. So what happened with me is that suddenly I was able to overproduce solutions for problems because I could imagine things farther away that before doing this was out of the scope. I'm not really referring to physics. My biggest production is in differential equations, methods, symmetry methods, and et cetera.
Yes. For quantum mechanics, do you have something like Feynman diagrams implemented?
Yes.
Looping?
Yes. The current version, here I presented a subset. There are many things. Actually, I skipped to mention but one, a whole package for differential geometry with more than 300 commands, just showing what we could do with that would take a whole week just showing nonstop. So yes, there are many things that were not shown here. Feynman diagrams is one. The current version has a restriction to 3 loops and up to 9 external legs, but we already have a new version running entirely in C that is supposed to appear in the new release by the end of this year. So no restrictions means no restrictions to number of loops, no restrictions to number of legs, external legs.
I know there was going to be the tutorial later today, but do you have online resources for training, like if one to start from scratch, learn how to do that?
Yes, there is indeed. at MapleSoft, there is one page entirely dedicated to the physics project. In that page, there is one link to a mini course in the use of the package in physics. It's a mini course, it's this 5 times 2 hours I gave in other places. It's a kind of workshop experience, 15 minutes talking, 1 hour and 45 with the people working each day, in order to jumpstart, get the minimum, and with that minimum, you can move by yourself. Now, that worksheet with the whole mini course is linked in that physics page of the MapleSoft site.
So you can work on that on your own, but if there's interest at Perimeter, we can also have a kind of a small crash course where people get together in a room and then look at that together, I don't know, twice a week for 2 weeks or something.
Oh, okay.
Do you have further questions? Yes, please.
Just maybe worth mentioning, can you show the out page?
Yes. So Oops, sorry, I don't have internet.
But
is public internet?
Yeah,
yeah, public. Good. There we are.
Yes, very good.
So let's see, bigger. This screen is small. So this is the MapleSoft reset page. Here we post weekly, but more than nothing, we post many times per week updates on the physics package that includes either bug fixes, problems that people notice, or new developments either related to people's feedback. Suppose you want this kind of, I think you asked about this simplification without having to take the conjugate. People make suggestions, OK, it would be nice if we could do this without having to do that. We implement things, and we put them available for everybody. And the links are all here. And here is the mini course that I was referring to. If you look for Google MapleSoft Physics Research, you will probably fall directly into this page. Okay, that's a different thing. I guess we can get something from here.
I think it's referring to the built-in help.
Yes, well, the online help is there. Now, this is the overview of the physics package, the list of commands, brief description, one bullet per command, what the hell these commands do, and so on. You click on any of them, and you get the help page for the corresponding command. For instance, this is for the Christoffel symbols, how they are defined, how does it work, examples, and so on. Yes?
Let's sharpen this up. Suppose I have a new graduate student who's never used Maple before. I do not have time to spoon feed this to them, and Eric isn't able to, he's not going to be able to organize this for months. If I hand them the disk or get it installed for them and say, here is the URL, you can teach yourself from that.
Yes.
Is there a page that will start with like Maple 101, which is how do I toggle between the text mode and the algebra mode?
Okay. There are two answers for that question. Let me give you first the physics answer. This mini course has 10 sections. The first five is Maple 101. So how do you do arithmetics? How do you do a function? How do you simplify, build a matrix, and do this basic stuff, take a derivative. Now, it's the physics answer. It's not the graphical user interface answer. So it won't explain you how you switch from 1D mode to 2D mode to the bunch of things that the GUI people implement. But there is a help for that within the system itself. So if you had a student here and he wants or she wants to learn how to use the package, including Maple, by going through this mini course, the five sections, first five sections would give Maple 101, and sections 5 to 10 would give from vector analysis to general relativity. Basically, it's one section per topic.
So what you're saying is that there is no online resource that the student can sit down at and teach themselves?
About the GUI, yes, but it's not what I provide in the mini course. About the physics and Maple 101, yes, it is in the mini course. But these are two different things. The syntax of the GUI, how do you switch between input notation of these things, this is not physics. Now, the Maple program itself has online help that allows you to follow and get all the information by yourself.
Right, that was the question I was asking.
OK.
This is part of Maple?
Yes. Well, the mini course is not part of Maple. Yes, but the answer to her question, yes. It now comes in the online help.
No, I think the physics package.
Yes, of course. It's distributed with Maple. It's produced by the company. It's supported by the company, tested by the company, and so on.
Okay. Are there further questions? Other comments? Okay. Thank you very much. Let's thank you for
the guest. Thank you.